everyone. If you want to hear more deep conversations that expand the way that you see the world, check out How to Be a Better Human, a podcast from TED. Each week on How to Be a Better Human, comedian and host Chris Duffy has refreshing, honest discussions with experts about the small ways that you can make changes in your life. This season, the show dives into ways that you can love better, create habits that stick, and think about architecture in a new way. Find all this and more on How to Be a Better Human. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Washington, D.C. Washington is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. It is named after a man who never told a lie. Now it's filled with men who seldom tell the truth.
Welcome to Portraits. I'm Kim Sayet, director of the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery. So imagine for a moment that you're here in Washington, D.C., standing on the National Mall. But it's 1862. The Capitol building is at one end, only its dome isn't finished. And the Washington Monument is at the other end, but it's a stub. Construction has been halted because, after all, we're in the middle of a civil war. And between these two landmarks, there's this really odd building with Gothic motifs. It's made from red sandstone that was quarried by enslaved people, and it looks kind of like a cross between a castle and a church. Inside, however, there's not a priest and not a king, but a scientist.
And so the whole idea was that science was a new religion, that knowledge pursuit was our kind of secular form of religion in American life.
That was cultural anthropologist Richard Curran. And the scientist living inside the castle, that was Joseph Henry, the first ever secretary of this new project known as the Smithsonian Institution.
Then he did have his laboratory in the castle and people would complain about it. The grounds were called the Smithsonian Pleasure Gardens.
Richard is going to take us back to the Smithsonian's founding 175 years ago. Before it had become the largest museum and research complex in the world. At the time, the castle was a lonely building that stood for progress, American style. And we'll also talk to the current secretary, Lonnie Bunch, about what counts as progress for him today. But as you know, we're all about the portraits. So we're going to start with a portrait from this same year in 1862 with Joseph Henry right in the middle. I asked Richard to describe it, and Richard, by the way, was speaking to us from inside the castle because his office used to be Joseph Henry's sitting room. Richard, welcome. In a way, you have become the Smithsonian Institution's historian. You've written a book, 101 Objects, about the history of the Smithsonian as told by the things that we look after. I'd like to start by asking you to describe this major painting that we're basing this episode around called The Men of Progress by Christian Schussel. What do you see when you're seeing all of these guys around this table?
This was in the middle of the 19th century, and this is a, you know, depiction of what many people at the time thought motivated society. These were some of the greatest inventors. They were never together in this portrait. This was a construed portrait. And it was kind of the idea of the promise of America, really, the idea that, that somehow knowledge and invention and progress would really color our country. And these are people that brought us everything from, you know, the telegraph to ways of making iron and improving railways and other things. So they really, you know, were taken as characterizing the progress in American life and American society.
So, Richard, as you know, I'm actually Dutch. And as a good little Dutch girl, I completely identify with the composition of this because it's very 17th century Dutch. It's all of these men They're all white men arranged so that everybody kind of gets equal billing. And to your point, they're all inventors, they're scientists. So you have people like Samuel Colt, and he's got actually a revolver, the revolving pistol, right next to him. And there's Charles Goodyear, who came up with vulcanized rubber, so Goodyear tires. It was actually commissioned by the guy who invented the coal-burning stove, Jordan Mott. So what is interesting is this, you know, this idea that progress was about science. Can you see who the patron saint of science is in this picture on the back wall?
You see Benjamin Franklin looking over the assembly.
It's Ben Franklin. Of course, everything leads to Ben in the end. The men in this painting are credited with finding better ways to harvest crops, produce newspapers, and sew clothing. And thanks to the industrial spirit on display here, our young, scrappy country would eventually overtake Europe economically. All the men in the painting are wearing dark suits with elegant, long overcoats, and there are miniature pattern models at their feet. In fact, these men are supposedly gathered in the old patent office, which today houses us, the National Portrait Gallery.
Patents, copyrights are enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. It's not that things belong to the king or the rulers or the state. Individuals can benefit from their inventions. And that helps incentivize, and there's all sorts of theories about what that did in America, but it really incentivized inventions. So rather, you know, people from very modest backgrounds could benefit if they invented something, and many people aspired to it. And so the idea is patent, invention, knowledge was our national religion.
Yeah. The old patent office was located between the Capitol on one side and the White House on the other, but it was also based on a church. So the architecture as neoclassical was based on the Parthenon in Greece. When Pierre L'Enfant came to lay out the plans for Washington, he said the old patent office, or of course then the new patent office, was going to be the temple of invention. So Richard, tell us more about the man in the middle of this painting, Joseph Henry, the first secretary of the Smithsonian.
You know, Henry was upstate New York, not a wealthy family or anything. He's what I guess we would call, it was natural science then, maybe a physicist is probably the best kind of description. And he was interested in a whole variety of scientific endeavors, from understanding issues with the sun and power to understanding energy. His term, the Henry, is actually a measure of energy.
Oh, is it really? There's the Henry?
Yeah, and he invented what was called the electronic relay. That was so key in the development of the telegraph, because the telegraph, you're stringing long lines of electricity, and if like a wave, you know, it peters out as it goes on, then it's not going to be effective.
Interesting. And in fact, Joseph Henry was having a massive fight with Samuel Morse, who is the other central figure sitting at the table. And as we know, Samuel Morse, well, whether he did or he did not, this is the big thing they were fighting about, was invented the telegraph in the 1840s. So before we move on from patents and inventions, I've just put up a picture, and it's a drawing taken from a patent. Can you describe it? Can you tell everyone at home what I've just shown you?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one, because this is a guy that went on to be president that actually put in a patent. And this was a system for boats in terms of rising and lowering water. And this was invented by a guy named Abraham Lincoln.
It wasn't very successful though, right? I mean, did they ever build the boat?
Yeah.
I don't think so. No, the idea was that these boats, these shallow bottom boats, would regularly get stuck on the side of rivers. So these giant kind of balloons, these flotation devices, would come out of the side of the boats and presumably push the boat back into the middle of the river. But it didn't work.
Well, we could have used it recently in the Suez Canal.
Yes, exactly.
Well, just to say off that, you know, Joseph Henry was Lincoln's science advisor.
Was he really? In fact, when Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, began holding seances in the White House, it was Joseph Henry that the president turned to with some of his concerns about her activities. He asked Henry to look into a medium that she was employing to make sure that he was on the up and up. But this portrait of the man of progress, it's just as interesting for the people who are not in it. Apart from the fact that there are no women, there are no African-American men of progress, for example. People like Solomon Brown.
So Solomon Brown was really a polymath in his own right. He was a poet. He was a naturalist. He's still to this day maybe the longest working Smithsonian employee. He worked for the Smithsonian for 54 years.
Wow.
So he worked for Morse and Henry, and he was key in laying the first telegraph line from Washington to Baltimore to test out the telegraph.
What hath God wrought? Right.
Yeah. Which we have. We have that first telegraph message. So Solomon Brown worked closely with Morse, worked closely with Henry. Henry was, as others in the portrait, what you'd call scientific racists of the time. And again, look at the picture. You know, everybody in it is white. There were certainly black inventors at the time, but they were left out and left out of the picture.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say that the National Portrait Gallery does not have a portrait of Solomon Brown, even though he was so impactful both to the Smithsonian and the nation. We do have this photograph. It's a black and white picture taken by an unknown artist dated to 1891. He's sitting on the steps of one of the side entrances of the castle wearing a bowler hat. He is looking directly out at you, but he's kind of a lonely figure. He's not with the others. This is the same time, 1862, when the painting is done, was when Joseph Henry actually did not allow Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, to speak in a series of lectures that was being held. There were a lot of sort of thought leaders giving talks at the Smithsonian around the time of the Civil War. And he said, you know, it was a step too far to actually ask a black man to talk in the castle. He had felt that, you know, politics had now crossed into the sort of the sacred space, I guess, of knowledge.
So you were too polite to Henry. He basically wrote to one of the regents, basically, I will not allow a colored man to speak in the rooms of the Smithsonian. Well, the Smithsonian's endowment was invested largely in southern states.
Oh, that's interesting.
So he was worried about that. So Henry did not fly an American flag over the Smithsonian castle during the Civil War. He said, we're an international organization.
The men of progress might have been inventing all sorts of things that benefited lots of people. But at the end of the day, their club was a really exclusive one.
I think Henry's notion was pretty narrow. The idea is that certain people would produce knowledge and then it would be distributed to the masses, you know, democratically. Well, I think that has evolved to a broader view that, hey, knowledge is going to come from all sorts of quarters, not just those guys in the portrait wearing suits and bow ties.
On the other side of the break, we're going to hear from the man sitting in Joseph Henry's seat today, Secretary Lonnie Bunch, and we'll do a little Men of Progress Photoshop. Stay with us.
If I could airbrush someone into the Men of Progress painting, I would choose Thurgood Marshall. His dedication to racial equality led to the ruling in the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court case. Without this ruling, I may not have had the educational opportunities that have defined my life.
I would add to Men of Progress two women. Admiral Grace Murray Hopper, Amazing Grace, was a mathematician and a pioneer of computer science, developing the first programming languages.
I might add maybe Rachel Carlson for her bringing environmental issues to popular attention through her writing.
If I could add someone to the Men of Progress portrait, I would add Sacagawea. She brings a diverse perspective to the expedition that is led by Lewis and Clark, navigating the land. She even uses her knowledge to help them find edible flowers and supplement rations. this Corps of Discovery expedition really sets off the progress of westward expansion and changes the United States as we know it.
Jane Addams pioneered the field of social work. Her work demonstrated that true progress involves not just an invention, but a benefit for society.
The Smithsonian Institution's origin story actually begins a little before the Men of Progress painting that we've been talking about. It starts off in England with another gentleman scientist named James Smithson. He was a chemist and a geologist. He was also the illegitimate son of a duke. So even though he became wealthy and he moved in elite circles, he was kind of marginalized. And, well, that might have put a chip on his shoulder. When he died in 1829, he left an unusual will. He essentially gifted his entire fortune to the United States, a place that he hadn't even visited. There was one condition, though. It had to found an institution in Washington, D.C. for, quote, the increase and diffusion of knowledge.
It's also about how do you extend the progress of America to everyone.
That's Secretary Lonnie Bunch. I showed him the same painting of the Men of Progress from the Civil War era, and I asked him, what did he see?
As a historian, it's a fascinating portrait, right? Because in some ways, this is really the engine of 19th century America, right? The economic engine. And this is also the sort of rationale, if you've noticed, that there aren't Southern planters. I mean, this is really about scientists. So it really is saying, you know, the economic and industrial might of the Union is really what has kept the country together. So I understand all of that. But I think it really raises the fundamental question of this is a vision. These are the people that will lead America to the promised land of greatness. And what we're arguing is they lead America to the promised land of economic possibility, of elitism. But they don't lead us to the promised land of a fairer America living up to its stated ideals. That's what's missing.
Right. At this point, Native Americans, African Americans, we've still got slavery happening, women, all of those people don't even have a vote. But what I think is fascinating about this is if we were to paint this today, Lonnie, you would be right at the center.
That's pretty amazing.
So if we go forward, you know, let's say that you are now presiding, who would you want to include in your people of progress, Lonnie?
There are three people that I think are really interesting, that really shape the course of a nation in a way that's equal, in some ways even greater than these folks, whether it's Frederick Douglass, who I think the world of. Here is somebody who began his life enslaved, who gained his freedom by running away, who was educated while he was enslaved, but he then built on that education and became probably the most prominent abolitionist. He was also in favor of women's suffrage, and he also recognized that his job was to challenge America to be fair. He became the conscience of a nation.
We have this portrait of him, a painting. It's the only one in existence that was done somewhere about 1845. We actually don't really know who the artist is. Can you describe that portrait? When you look at Frederick Douglass here, what do you see?
Well, when you look at the portrait of Frederick Douglass, you see that he's mixed race, right? So therefore, he is really a product of that system of slavery. You also see, however, that it's important for him in this painting to be not what people think of a runaway slave. He really is the epitome of sort of almost a young dandy, the way his hair is parted, the tie he's wearing. And it was also crucially important for Douglass through this portrait to let people know that he aspired to middle-class respectability. I mean, as you know, Frederick Douglass is the most photographed man in 19th century America, and it was intentional.
Well, who else would you have at the table with you? If you could, you know, it's a little bit like that story of who would you want to have for dinner? Who else would you invite at your table?
Well, you know, for me, I am a big lover of Eleanor Roosevelt. I just think this is one of the most amazing people that ever existed. I mean, first of all, here is somebody that grows up in an elite family. She's, you know, cousins of Teddy Roosevelt and marries another cousin, Franklin Roosevelt. And she was raised to sort of be on someone's arm. And yet here is a woman who said, it's not enough for me to be a wife or be the traditional first lady.
You know, what's kind of interesting is that she was quite shy. She had to really train herself to be able to speak in public and have that sort of self-confidence to be in front of people. Similarly to that, she did not like having her portrait taken. We have a photograph of Eleanor Roosevelt done by Yusuf Karsh, but he's definitely glamorized her. She's got the pearls on and she's holding a pencil and she's got sort of a glittery top.
I think that the photograph really does suggest, you know, there are certain strictures that I even have to deal with. You know, the way you said, the pearls, the glamour. But what I love is somehow the notion of the pencil in the hand and the way her hands are placed suggests activity, right? So you can put me in the kind of pose that you think many women should be in. But I'm going to also remind you that for me, it is less about my look and more about my hands. I love the fact that Eleanor Roosevelt was really one of the first ladies to really dip her hands into the challenge of race. Whether it is after World War II, when her husband was agreed to inter many Japanese Americans because of the kind of racist fears of the war, she spoke out against that. Or whether it was the fact that she was close to African Americans like Mary Cloud Methuen and Ralph Bunche and
others. Marian Anderson, yeah.
I mean, so basically what she did was explode what a woman was supposed to care about. One of the things that was so moving to me is watching her get involved and helping to create the United Nations.
I'm going to read you the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, therefore,
she kicked down so many doors to go to then being one of the leaders in the U.S. delegation.
To promote respect for these rights and freedoms.
To then go on to being a woman that has a sort of an amazing newspaper column. She was looking to an era where women had something to say, but more importantly, women had power.
Perhaps your most severe critic, Westbrook Pegler. He said, this woman is a political force of enormous ambitions. I believe she is a menace. Unscrupulous as to truth, vain, and cynical.
She was called socialist. She was called an amalgamator. She was called too pro-Negro.
It seems to me a little exaggerated, let us say. No one could be quite as bad as all that.
For many of the people and the men of progress, it's about science. And for her, it was about fairness.
Lonnie's third person of progress has been called the godmother of civil rights.
A woman who was also shy, a woman who was also told that, well, you know, thank you, make the coffee, but don't make history. And that would be Dorothy Height.
Dorothy Height presided over the National Council of Negro Women for four decades, and you might have seen her photograph without even knowing it. She was at arm's length from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. when he spoke at the Lincoln Memorial in 1963. Did you meet her? Did you know Dorothy Height?
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness. Oh, Dorothy Height, you know, you felt like you better have a tie on and your shoes better be shine. because, you know, you sort of felt like you were going to the epitome of respectability. And especially African-American respectability, this notion of, you know, making sure she had more hats to wear to church and the right gloves. This was a woman that carried respect.
Yeah, she died at the age of 98, remarkably long life in 2010. And President Barack Obama eulogized her at the funeral. He said, quote, that the hats she wore were like a crown.
She was a quintessential Black churchwoman. And the hats tend to be flamboyant. You know, there's nothing worse than being behind somebody with a big hat when you're trying to see at the wedding or something, right? I've done that many a time. You basically see hats that really reflect beauty, color, but really reflect substance and heft.
You know, it's that whole thing about the armor or the strategy of dress, right? And it actually goes all the way back to Frederick Douglass, who understood that.
You put your finger on it. It's really important. You know, when we did a show with the Portrait Gallery collections years ago at the museum, Let Your Model Be Resistance, we recognized that the way you presented yourself was a symbol of resistance. Looking at Dorothy Hyde also tells us about sexism within the civil rights movement. Here you have the March on Washington in 1963 with Martin Luther King, and initially no women were asked to speak. And Dorothy Hyde made sure that Daisy Bates and Josephine Baker would have a chance to speak. But what's interesting is they didn't get a chance to speak as part of the main program. It was the kind of ancillary program. But be that as it may, it was Dorothy Hyde who demanded that women's roles be recognized.
Those are just three change makers that Lonnie would include as people of progress. And there are so many more that we could talk about. But at the end of the day, when I look at the original Men of Progress painting, I can't help but think that they'd have to be pretty impressed by what we've become. We have 19 museums, 21 libraries, 9 research centres, and a zoo. In fact, we're the largest research complex in the world, with 2 more museums on the way. I asked Lonnie what he thought about in terms of the legacy left to us by James Smithson and Joseph Henry and Solomon Brown.
The Smithsonian is always going to be that place of wonder, of science, of history and art, but it also has to be the place that I know Frederick Douglass would have wanted us to be, which is a beacon that helps hold the country together by giving clear truth. I think that what we're trying to suggest is that, first of all, we want to democratize knowledge. You can tell a lot about a nation by how democratic it is in its knowledge sharing. So I think that looking at a 19th century image like that, these were the elite. We're now arguing that the great strength of America is that that picture would be populated by a lot of different people who have access to knowledge. And even more importantly, their access to knowledge broadens our understanding of that knowledge. So it's not just a one-way street.
I want to extend a special thank you to Mary Ellen Michelle, Charlie Allegrone, Hilary Fisk, and Lauren Davidson, whose voices you heard naming their own people of progress. They are all volunteers at the gallery, and they are diffusing knowledge all the time. Remember, you can see the portraits that we've talked about in the show notes and on our website. Or you can come in person and see them. Our doors are now open again after pandemic closures. Our podcast team includes Ruth Morris, Justin O'Neill, Anne Cannanan, Deborah Sism, Rebecca Casemeyer, and Rebecca Ortiz Hernandez. Our theme music is by Joe Kai, and Tarek Fuda is our engineer. Until next time, I'm Kim Sayette.